It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Janice Dean.
I'm Jason Chaffetz.
I'm Harris Faulkner. And this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, March 21st, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Some legal wrangling puts a Texas law back on hold that would see local law enforcement arresting undocumented immigrants.
What I see over there in D.C., you know, that for them to get together and find a solution and work together, don't turn it into a political issue.
I'm Dave Anthony. U.S. citizens stuck in Haiti keep trying to get out to escape gang violence that's overrun parts of the country. We take you to its border with the Dominican Republic.
And the State Department has, you know, told Americans that are traveling by land to border crossings like this one to travel at their own risk. This is a lot of it is gang-controlled territory, and to keep a low profile.
And I'm Jason Rance. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
A Texas law would make illegally crossing the border into the U.S. from Mexico a state misdemeanor punishable with jail time. Under SB 4, Texas judges would have to order undocumented migrants deported, and local law enforcement would have to take migrants to the border. But this law, SB 4, was blocked by a federal judge. He said it threatens the fundamental notion that the U.S. must regulate immigration with one voice from the federal government. A panel of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed that ruling, but Tuesday the Supreme Court said the law could be enforced while the legal arguments in this case play out. Hours later, a different panel of the Fifth Circuit said, no, the law cannot be enforced, as they held a hearing playing out the legal arguments Wednesday.
Everybody's concerned about the border. There's a real crisis going on here. Texas has decided that we are at the epicenter of this crisis. We are on the front line, and we are going to do something about it.
Texas Solicitor Aaron Nielsen told the Fifth Circuit Court that Texas has a right to defend itself, and under any possible reading of that right, at least some applications of SB 4 are constitutional. But Justice Department Attorney Daniel Tenney says Texas goes too far, that they want to put people in jail for being undocumented.
State judges will be making determinations about the legality of someone's entry into the United States. And that was something that this court in Farmers Branch and the Supreme Court in Arizona said states simply are not supposed to be doing.
At a Texas Policy Forum summit, Texas Governor Greg Abbott highlighted the number of actions the state's taken without federal approval, including building more border wall as an unprecedented number of migrants arrives.
What's going on at the border is nothing short of catastrophic.
While the case continues to play out and may end up back before the Supreme Court in a bid for the high court to consider the merits of the case, Mexico's president criticized the bill Wednesday, saying they will not accept deportations from the Texas government, calling the law dehumanizing.
If we can continue working with a long-term operation the way we have, then we can do it.
Tom Schmerber is the sheriff of Maverick County, Texas.
Because what we have is an MOU, which is a memorandum of understanding of the state, the troopers. Anything that is arrested here in this county, Maverick County, they take them to Valverde, which is over there in Del Rio, Texas, and they'll process over there, and they're going to magistrate over there, and then they send them to another jail, which is fine. But if it's going to be different, I don't have the space in this jail right now. I don't have the manpower, nor the technology. It takes me 45 minutes to do one single individual here to book them. And you know the immigrants are not going to come here by one by one. They come here in groups.
Right. And you just referenced, you said if you have help from Lone Star, that's the operation put into effect by the governor of Texas there, Greg Abbott. You had previously said it was helpful this year when the governor under Operation Lone Star sent you guys, I guess, hundreds of state law enforcement officers to that area. How did that help you, and how do you foresee them maybe helping you moving forward if SB 4 is enforced?
It helped me a lot at the beginning, a lot up till now, because we have that understanding that they're going to help me. They're helping me right now in doing all this booking and administrating, putting all these immigrants in other jails. And he gave us a lot of a grant, which is called Long Star Operation Grant, good money. But now the second grant that came in was given instead of to the Sheriff Department, it was given to the county attorney. So now I have to request whatever I need through him, and he sometimes will not agree on what I'm asking for. I haven't had a meeting yet with a trooper or a captain, major, anything in reference to how we're going to do it. So I'm still waiting.
Yeah. One of the questions before the appeals court, one of the judges asked the attorney for Texas, how all do you think this law is going to be enforced? How will things work?
Well, yeah, the understanding is that we are not going to deport anybody. It's because it all depends on a judge. You know, what I understand is we have to apprehend one and write him up for trespassing, and then he'll be magistrated. It's a state law, and if the court takes a long time, eventually I won't have any more space for immigrants nor criminals that are in this area.
Now, Sheriff, the head of the Border Sheriffs Coalition, the sheriff of Hidalgo County, he said that he thinks they aren't equipped to be immigration agents and do the kind of work that SB 4 is calling for. Over the years, many sheriff's departments have had 287G programs, though. That's allowed them to work with ICE or call ICE when they're dealing with a suspected undocumented migrant. It's not the exact same as SB 4, but do you agree with him that deputies aren't really equipped to do the kind of work that SB 4 in particular is calling for?
Well, the deputies are not really trained for immigration work, but we do work with immigration. We work with ICE, which is HSI. We work with U.S. Marshals. And, you know, we do work with other agencies, and it's very important for us to work together. And that's the main thing. We'll work with that because we have deputies, but some of the deputies that we have are kind of new, you know, they don't stay long with us, 2 or 3 years, and they change. But I feel very confident. I retired from the Border Patrol, and I feel very confident that we're going to have a lot of assistance from the ICE department, from the marshals, and of course from the state, the troopers.
A couple months ago, I read that you'd said that you were afraid of the high number of people coming, especially of the certain types of people that might be among them. I wonder, can you compare what you're seeing now as a sheriff in Maverick County, 2023, 2024, to what you dealt with as an agent back after 9/11?
Yeah, before that, it was just simple immigrants that were coming to work, and not in big groups, you know. You can tell there was just regular people that are coming here to work and not to stay. The majority were not here to stay. But now this changed a lot. This is kind of like it opened doors, and people were coming here to stay. And, of course, with that, the criminal element took advantage, and we had drugs coming through here, burglaries, and we had one situation where an immigrant from Honduras raped one of the senior citizens, female. She was like 74 years old, you know. So it changed a lot. Very different.
Along the Rio Grande River in the Eagle Pass area is a 47-acre park, Shelby Park, where state law enforcement erected concertina wire on top of shipping containers, blocking migrants from entering. While there was a legal fight over access to the park between the federal government and state government, the Supreme Court eventually said the federal government, in this case Border Patrol agents, could go ahead and cut down that concertina wire. But no one ever said specifically that Governor Abbott couldn't simply order troopers and state law enforcement to put more wire back up. It appears the wire hasn't been cut down, and the flow of people since has shifted west to Arizona and California.
I feel bad for the mayor because they had a lot of activities that was going to happen. Usually this month, you know, they have a fiesta, so they call it fiestas and so forth. You know, of course, you know, I don't know if they're going to lose any money. But if it's working, that's fine. I mean, as long as it's working, I mean, send them somewhere else, fine. Anything that works.
Anything that works to stop. So what do you mean by that? Because there was a big fight between the Biden administration, right, and local officials there, state officials there, I should say, about how things were being handled at Shelby Park, and the high court saying, you know, that they could go ahead and cut down that concertina wire, but then it didn't end up being cut down really by the Border Patrol, I guess. It was left up, maybe. I don't know what the status is. Even though that wasn't done, you know, by the federal government, that was done by the state government, right? Those troopers and state folks put up that wire and put those shipping containers on there. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I don't think that the wire stopped anything because they were still coming, even the wire was there and so forth. I think that, you know, the state government had several meetings with the state government from Mexico. I think they had a lot to do with it too, you know, not just the physical thing, you know, but I think that had worked a lot. Talking to, I know that the Governor Abbott had a meeting with the president from Mexico, so maybe they helped a lot, 100%.
Yeah, I know you've been talking to people who live in Maverick County, but also probably some migrants yourself, or maybe you've heard from your deputies about what migrants say. What are you, I guess, what are you hearing about why people are here, where they want to go once they're here, what they want to do?
They don't want to stay here in the border. You know, they're not want to stay here. They're not looking for staying here. They're going up north. A lot of people are saying they're going to go to New Jersey, Chicago, some other states, you know, up north. That's what they want to go. And they're asking because they're saying because they want to find a job over there. They think there's another job. They think there's good money. But they know that here on the border, I mean, we don't have a lot of jobs for especially for the immigrants. So that's what I hear, that they want to keep on going north.
And are you hearing that a lot of people are not just from like Northern Triangle countries and, you know, Mexico? These folks are from all over the world. We've seen that in video,
Yeah, exactly. They're all over the world. And the majority of the people that are coming in have no skills. So I don't know. I think they're going to have a hard time trying to find a job. The only jobs they're going to find are going to be hard labor, I mean, but not they don't have any skills.
Has this been frustrating at all to you, seeing the high numbers of people or watching the political fight in D.C., you know, between Congress and the White House?
Yeah.
Have you been frustrated? And what would you, I guess, what would you want to have happen?
What I see over there in D.C., you know, that for them to get together and find a solution and work together. I mean, don't turn it into a political issue, because the situation is already out of control. So, and the law enforcement officers like us, we're in the middle, you know, trying to see what's going to happen. So if they can work together, really, really work together, I think they would have a solution right away, and this problem would stop. But it had to take the two parties to find something, some kind of solution.
Did you think that border bill that the Republicans said what didn't go far enough, would you have liked to have seen that passed or no?
Well, I don't know the details, but if that was the solution, I'm hoping, you know, for the situation to keep on going on and on and on, you know. So I don't know if they're waiting for the elections or something like that, but still we have months ahead of us.
Sheriff Tom Schmerber, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. Far too often, women's lives are cut short as they fall victim to unthinkable crimes. But each week this month, I'll be joined by women who fought back, survived, and took back control. You won't want to miss this month's stories of survival, strength, and resilience. Listen and download on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Jason Rantz with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Parts of Haiti are lawless, with no government in place anymore, after the prime minister, who's not even in Haiti, resigned.
People of Haiti, wake up.
That man's among the many residents distraught in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, where gangs have taken control, fighting each other in violence that's left innocent civilians among the dead.
The situation Haiti faces is tragic. It's a crisis of epic proportion that's been building for a long time now, and it has no easy solutions to it.
Republican Senator Marco Rubio posted this on X.
Our number one priorities are, number one, U.S. citizens and their loved ones who are there, maybe trapped, unable to get out. It's important that we secure their well-being. We're also concerned, obviously, for the poor people of Haiti who are suffering. But again, there's not a lot of good options in the short term when you have roving gangs of maniacs who are killing and slaughtering people. And the hope is that they'll be able to bring some stability there through some security force that is supposed to come eventually from Kenya.
In the meantime, several hundred Americans have found a way out, but it is not easy. We take you now to the border there.
So this is the main border crossing out of Haiti into the Dominican Republic in Dajabón.
Brian Yenes is a Fox News national correspondent near a Dominican market where Haitians can go to find much-needed food and supplies.
super important for the Haitians considering what's happening in their country. But also it is an exit point for foreigners, particularly Americans, to get out of Haiti. So what we've been seeing here is a very controlled situation. The Dominican military and their version of the Border Patrol, CESFRONT, has the situation controlled here. We have not seen a mass exodus of Haitians in this area. We are about a six-hour drive away from Port-au-Prince and about a couple hours away from Cap Haitien. And so these are the two cities in which we've seen most of these, seen a lot of the action, but that's we've seen about 400 Americans who have used this border crossing to leave Haiti, and the State Department has told Americans that are traveling by land to border crossings like this one to travel at their own risk. This is a lot of it is gang-controlled territory, and to keep a low profile.
Yeah, let's get into what's happened in Haiti. You mentioned the capital. Port-au-Prince is where the biggest problems have occurred with gangs overrunning the streets and overrunning neighborhoods, taking over. Is there much government left in Haiti in the capital?
No, as a matter of fact, there aren't really any elected officials at all that are in any position of power to govern. So right now what you have is a Haitian capital that is 80% under the control of gangs, and it's not just one gang, it's many gangs. Up to 200 rival gangs are now in control of the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. And the one name everyone talks about is Barbecue, Jimmy Cherizier. He's the top gang leader, reportedly, and his name is Barbecue. That's his nickname. And so there are fractions we already seeing of different gangs that are taking to the streets, and not only are they attacking one another, they're attacking civilian infrastructure. Schools, police stations, government buildings have all come under attack as these gangs battle one another. And the latest crisis really started on February 29th when Barbecue, the gang leader, started to launch these attacks against government infrastructure in a way in which they were left, bodies were left on the public streets, and the crisis really kind of took a new foothold. And he did this to force the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, to resign. And so the Prime Minister said that he would, while he was outside of the country, he would resign once a transnational council of Haitians that represent different political groups was put together to choose a new president and effectively choose a new government. There is no acting real parliament, no acting president or prime minister at this point with the resignation of Ariel Henry that can control the Haitian people or the government and bring peace. And so in that power vacuum, you've got 200 gangs that are rivaling one another, and this is where you're getting the violence. And there is no guarantee that these gangs are going to respect any new government that's put in place.
How is the U.S. dealing with that? How can we get Americans or others who are trapped there in the capital out? We did have the military go in to deal with embassy employees, right, and staff at the embassy, but that's all the military's done. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, that is that, and therein lies the interesting situation here with how the State Department is handling this, because the initial conversation last week was, towards the end of last week, was, you know what, Americans, we have told you for the last 4 years, it is a level 4 State Department warning, do not travel to Haiti. We've warned you. There were no active evacuation plans last week to get Americans out. And then over the weekend, all of a sudden, we saw the one and only charter flight as of now from the State Department, organized by the State Department, take off from Cap Haitien with over 30 Americans on board. But since then, all we've heard from the State Department is that they are continuing to explore safe evacuation routes out of Haiti. But there are about 1,000 Americans who remain stranded in Haiti. The Marines have gone into Haiti, but only to evacuate non-essential staff from the Port-au-Prince U.S. Embassy. So ultimately, you've got American civilians who have been left to their own devices to travel at their own risk by land, or to reach out to rescue nonprofit organizations like Project Dynamo, or like we've seen with Republican Corey Mills, who took it upon himself, a combat veteran, to lead 2 rescue operations to save at least 23 Americans. So at this moment, the State Department, over the last 5 days, continues to say that they're exploring evacuation options, but we have not seen any new charter flights of any significance, and the U.S. says they're now trying to get more evacuation options secured between the Port-au-Prince and into the Dominican Republic, the capital of Santo Domingo, its closest neighbor. And from there, Americans would then have to, on their own, figure out a way to get out of DR.
obviously, Haiti's a poor country, and they've had a lot of problems in the past with hunger and humanitarian crises. This certainly is going to add to that. Can any humanitarian supplies get into Port-au-Prince or even Cap-Haitien?
Yeah, the United Nations has opened. There have been containers of humanitarian aid, and the UN does have a way to get containers of aid inside of Port-au-Prince into Haiti. But the United Nations has been warning for a while now that they are in dire need of more money and of more help. It's something like $640 million worth of humanitarian aid is what the UN says Haiti needs, and they've only received less than 10% of that money that the UN says this nation needs to provide the kind of aid to Haitians who desperately need it right now. We're talking about 1.4 million Haitians who face famine, over 360,000 Haitians who have been displaced in their own country. You've got the violence, you've got no working government, and you've got a situation now where it's dire. You speak to Haitians here in the market in Dajabón, Dominican Republic. Again, this is the location where we are is really critical because there is a binational market that allows Haitian migrants to come in for a day, a couple days a week, and to buy and sell the goods they desperately need. And they come by the thousands and go right back to their country. It's an important market for them right now, but we spoke to some Haitians there who said, frankly, they do want an international police force to go in and take care of the gangs. And you can also see on their faces, they are tired. It is. One woman told me, you know, she's got six kids and she lives in one room. She has no house. And she says it's just crisis after crisis. They put in a new president and then there's another president after. She was just so exhausted by it all. But she is still pleading with the international community to help. And then Dominicans say the international community has to come in and help. And then they hopefully that the Haitian government, new government can work with the DR, its closest neighbor, to kind of turn the page and try to get after what has been just crisis after crisis, particularly over the last 15 years.
Brian, who would lead an international force that would go into Haiti? I mean, I know that Caribbean leaders are working to try to come up with some sort of a transitional government. How much does the U.S. get involved in this international force?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a U.S.-led effort to bring Caribbean leaders. There was a conference in Jamaica in which they decided to negotiate with Haitian political groups and to create a transnational council who then will decide how to move forward with general elections, which have not taken place in Haiti since 2016, and how to move forward with installing or putting in a new president and a new government. So that is being led in part by the U.S. and with other Caribbean nations. And then in terms of the international police force, that is being led by Kenya. Prime Minister Ariel Henry was actually visiting Kenya at the time in which all of this started here on February 29th, and he was talking to them and pleading with them to bring an international force. Now, Kenya had agreed last year that they were going to be doing this, but it has stalled for various reasons, funding and concerns domestically with Kenya about whether or not they should be even doing this and why they would be doing this. Even recently, there's been some concerns about U.S. funding for this force. But the Kenyans still say, the Kenyan president says that they still plan on leading an international police force, but there are no guarantees here, and there's a lot of skepticism that a new transnational council will get it done, that they'll come to some consensus, and that a new government can ever be formed that will get the respect of some 200 rival gangs. So a lot of questions left here, and all of that, also logistical questions as to how this is going to happen, because the Dominicans want nothing to do with getting involved in any kind of an armed conflict or even the appearance of an armed conflict with their neighbor.
There is a concern. All the chaos in Haiti could lead to an exodus of Haitians fleeing to the U.S. We have seen that before. You may recall the controversy in 2021 when more than 10,000 Haitian migrants gathered under a bridge at the Mexican border in Del Rio, Texas. Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has deployed crews off the coast to intercept any boats carrying Haitian migrants.
Florida Fish and Wildlife officers interdicted a vessel that had 25 illegal immigrants, potential illegal immigrants from Haiti. In their boat, in their vessel, they had firearms, they had drugs, they had night vision gear.
Governor DeSantis has also threatened to fly Haitian migrants to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, something he's controversially done before with other migrants who are here illegally.
Absolutely, we can see an influx. It hasn't happened yet. The Dominican border authorities here tell you it has not happened yet, but that always remains a possibility. As that situation gets worse, people are going to be wanting a way out. There are up to a million, maybe 2 million. There isn't really an official number of Haitian migrants who have found life and are living in the Dominican Republic because they simply cannot live in Haiti. And there's been over 100,000, about 150,000 Haitians who've come to the U.S. over the last couple of years. So Florida is preparing for a potential exodus, but so is the Dominican Republic. The president here has spent the last couple of years building a border wall, 100 miles worth of border wall that we visited. And you also have the Dominican government continuing its deportations. The United States is concerned about an exodus, but you better believe that Haiti's closest neighbor, the Dominican Republic, is extra concerned, and they have made border security a high priority. So right now, no mass exodus, but they are prepared for anything at this point, with the gangs still very much in control of Haiti's capital.
Brian Innes, Fox News national correspondent, who has a front row seat to the crisis in Haiti right along the border in Dajabon in the Dominican Republic. Brian, thanks very much for joining us.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Meet the American who
was the founding father that put the work in working man. George Taylor was born in Northern Ireland around 1716 and immigrated to America, where he became an ironsmith in Lehigh, Pennsylvania. Taylor originally wanted to study medicine, but like many other Irishmen, found work as an indentured servant for the Durham Iron Works on the Delaware River. Empowered by the ideals of American independence, he worked tirelessly, shoveling coal into a blistering furnace, and eventually worked his way up to a manager position. According to the Durham Historical Society, Taylor's skills undeniably surpassed iron works, which caught the eye of the iron mill owner's wife, Anne Savage. Taylor assumed a position as the head of the operation and soon married the recently widowed Anne the next year. Aside from running the mill, Taylor was also a member of Pennsylvania's Committee of Correspondence and even served as captain for the state militia. When America finally won its independence from Britain, Taylor was one of 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. He then utilized his expertise of the iron industry to assist the Continental Army in developing cannons, cannonballs, and other military equipment. Taylor forsaked financial gain to completely dedicate his life to fortifying an independent America. After contracting a deadly illness, he retired from public service and later passed away on February 23, 1781, in Easton, Pennsylvania. He was 65 years old. George Taylor's story embodies the American dream and represents the contributions of Irish Americans to the forging of our great nation. Up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jason Rantz.
What's on your mind?
As the crisis at our border escalates, Democrats are working tirelessly to deflect attention from the alarming reality that illegal immigrants are committing crimes in American cities coast to coast. Democrats are acutely aware that every time an illegal immigrant commits a crime, the spotlight inevitably falls on their complicity. In the aftermath of the tragic murder of Laken Riley, a young nursing student, allegedly by an illegal immigrant from Venezuela, Democrat mouthpieces rushed to peddle the same tired narrative that illegal immigrants commit fewer crimes than American citizens. NPR and Glenn Kessler of The Washington Post recently parroted studies claiming lower incarceration rates among male immigrants compared to native-born individuals. No one is arguing that illegal immigrants commit more crimes than Americans, unless, of course, you count their unlawful entry. The issue is that they commit crimes at all while being in the country illegally. These crimes wouldn't occur if our border security was effective. In my latest book, What's Killing America? Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities, out right now on Amazon, I expose the fallacy of data-driven claims about illegal immigrant crimes. Take, for instance, the astonishing number of illegal immigrants charged with crimes in West Coast states like Washington, Oregon, and California. Are you ready for it? The number is zero, thanks to sanctuary state policies that prohibit law enforcement from inquiring about citizenship status. When you're charged with shoplifting in San Francisco, hit and run in Portland, or assault in Seattle, citizenship status is not ascertained due to sanctuary policies.
This lack of documentation creates a distorted picture of crime rates, especially in sanctuary cities where cases potentially leading to deportation are avoided. When an illegal immigrant commits a crime and avoids jail time through diversion programs, their citizenship status remains undocumented. Now, if crimes are intentionally left unpunished to conceal citizenship status, how can we trust the crime rate data? Furthermore, the influx of unknown illegal immigrants crossing the border complicates accurate assessments of their crime rates compared to American cities. While Democrats downplay these crimes, innocent Americans suffer the consequences. Just this month, a tragic incident received little national attention. An illegal immigrant with a lengthy criminal history is accused of killing a 27-year-old Washington State trooper, Christopher Gatt, who left behind a wife and 2-year-old daughter. According to court documents, Raul Benitez Santana admitted to drinking and smoking weed before allegedly crashing into the trooper's vehicle north of Seattle on Interstate 5 early one weekend morning. ICE confirmed Santana is in the country illegally from Mexico. It's unclear when he entered this country illegally, but he served jail time twice since 2013 and was initially charged with a crime that would have made him eligible for deportation if only anyone was legally allowed to ask about his citizenship status. This is just one example of how illegal immigration leads to preventable tragedies. Democrats' open border agenda has real consequences, as more innocent Americans fall victim to crimes that could have been avoided with stricter immigration policies. It's time for Democrats to acknowledge the dangers posed by illegal immigration and prioritize the safety of American citizens over political agendas. The denial of this reality only perpetuates the cycle of crime and victimization in our communities. I'm Jason Rantz, author of What's Killing America? Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities. I'm Jason Rantz.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.